Chapter 10.
"What was that?" a voice called out.
"It sounded like a harpoon gun being fired," cried another voice.
"A harpoon gun?" asked a third voice. "This is supposed to be a hotel, not a shooting gallery."
"I heard a splash," cried someone.
"Me too," agreed someone else. "It sounded like somebody fell into the pond."
The Baudelaire orphans gazed at the settling surface of the pond and saw the reflections of shutters and windows opening on every story of the Hotel Denouement. Lights went on, and the silhouettes of people appeared, leaning out of the windows and pointing down at the weeping children, who were too upset to pay much attention to all the shouting.
"What's all this shouting about?" asked another voice. "I'm as fast asleep."
"It's the middle of the night," complained someone else. "Why is everybody yelling?"
"I'll tell you why there's yelling," yelled someone.
"Someone was shot with a harpoon gun and then fell into the pond."
"Come back to bed, Bruce," said someone else.
"I can't sleep if there's murderers on the loose," cried another guest.
"Amen, brother," said another person. "If a crime has been committed, then it's our duty to stand around in our pajamas in the name of justice."
"I can't sleep anyway," said somebody.
"That lousy Indian food has kept me up all night."
"Somebody tell me what's going on," called a voice. "The readers of the Daily Punctilio will want to know what's happened."
The sound of the voice of Geraldine Julien and the mention of her inaccurate publication forced the children to stop crying, if only for a moment. They knew it would be wise to postpone their grief, a phrase which here means mourn the death of Dewey Denouement at a later time, and make sure that the newspaper printed the truth.
"There's been an accident," Violet called, not turning her eyes from the surface of the pond. "A terrible accident." "One of the hotel managers has died," Klaus said.
"Which one?"
asked a voice from a high window.
"Frank or Ernest?"
"Dewey,"
Sonny said. "There's no Dewey," said another voice. "That's a legendary figure."
"He's not a legendary figure," Violet said indignantly. "He's a sub—"
Klaus put his hand on his sister's, and the eldest Baudelaire stopped talking.
"Dewey's catalogue is a secret," he whispered. "We can't have it announced in the Daily Punctilio."
"But truth," Sonny murmured.
"Klaus is right," Violet said.
"Dewey asked us to keep his secret, and we can't fail him."
She looked sadly out of the pond and wiped the tears from her eyes.
"It's the least we can do," she said.
"Oh, I didn't realize this was a sad occasion," said another hotel guest. "We should observe everything carefully and intrude only if absolutely necessary."
"I disagree,"
said someone in a raspy shout.
"We should intrude right now and observe only if absolutely necessary."
"We should call the authorities," said someone else. "We should call the manager. We should call the concierge. We should call my mother. We should look for clues. We should look for weapons. We should look for my mother. We should look for suspicious people."
"Suspicious people?"
repeated another voice. "But this is supposed to be a nice hotel."
"Nice hotels are crawling with suspicious people," someone else remarked. "I saw a washerwoman who was wearing a suspicious wig.
I saw a concierge carrying a suspicious item. I saw a taxi carrying a suspicious passenger. I saw a cook preparing suspicious food. I saw an attendant holding a suspicious spatula. I saw a man with a suspicious cloud of smoke. I saw a baby with a suspicious lock. I saw a manager wearing a suspicious uniform. I saw a woman wearing suspicious lettuce. I saw my mother."
"I can't see anything," someone yelled. "It's as dark as a crow flying through a pitch-black night."
"I see something right now," cried a voice. "There are three suspicious people standing at the edge of the pond."
"They're the people who were talking to the reporter," cried somebody else. "They're refusing to show their faces."
"They must be murderers," cried yet another person.
"Nobody else would act as suspiciously as that." "We'd better hurry downstairs," said one more guest, "before they escape."
"Wow!" squealed another voice. "Wait until the readers of the Daily Punctilio read the headline, 'Vicious Murder at Hotel Denouement.' That's much more exciting than an accident."
"Mob psychology," Sonny said.
remembering a term Klaus had taught her shortly before she took her first steps. "Sonny's right," said Klaus, wiping his eyes. "This crowd is getting angrier and angrier. In a moment they'll all believe we're murderers."
"Maybe we are," Violet said quietly.
"Poppycock,"
Sonny said firmly, which meant something like nonsense.
"Accident."
"It was an accident," Klaus said, "but it was our fault."
"Partially,"
Sonny said. "It's not for us to decide," Violet said. "We should go inside and talk to Justice Strauss and the others. They'll know what to do."
"Maybe," Klaus said. "Or maybe we should run."
"Run?"
Sonny asked.
"We can't run," Violet said.
"If we run, everyone will think we're murderers."
"Maybe we are," Klaus pointed out.
"All the noble people in that lobby have failed us. We can't be sure they'll help us now."
Violet heaved a great sigh, her breath still shaky from her tears.
"Where would we go?" she whispered.
"Anywhere," Klaus said simply.
"We could go somewhere where no one has ever heard of Count Olaf or VFD. There must be other noble people in the world, and we could find them."
"There are other noble people," Violet said. "They're on their way here. Dewey told us to wait until tomorrow. I think we should stay."
"Tomorrow might be too late," Klaus said. "I think we should run."
"Torn,"
Sonny said, which meant something along the lines of, "I see the advantages and disadvantages of both plans of action." But before her siblings could answer, the children felt a shadow over them and looked up to see a tall, skinny figure standing over them. In the darkness, the children could not see any of his features, only the glowing tip of a skinny cigarette in his mouth.
"Do you three need a taxi?"
he asked, and gestured to the automobile that had brought Justice Strauss and Jerome Squalor to the entrance of the hotel. The siblings looked at one another, and then squinted up at the man. The children thought perhaps his voice was familiar, but it might just have been his unfathomable tone, which they'd heard so many times since their arrival at the hotel, that it made everything seem familiar and mysterious at the same time.
"We're not sure," Violet said after a moment.
"You're not sure?"
the man asked.
"Whenever you see someone in a taxi, they're probably being driven to do some errand. Surely there must be something you need to do, or somewhere you need to go. A great American novelist wrote that people travel faster now, but she wasn't sure if they do better things. Maybe you would do better things if you travelled at this very moment."
"We haven't any money," Klaus said.
"You needn't worry about money," the man said. "Not if you're who I think you are."
He leaned in toward the Baudelaires. "Are you?" he asked. "Are you who I think you are?" The children looked at each other again. They had no way of knowing, of course, if this man was a volunteer or an enemy, a noble man or a treacherous person. In general, of course, a stranger who tries to get you into an automobile is anything but noble. And in general, a person who quotes great American novelists is anything but treacherous. And in general, a man who says you needn't worry about money, or a man who smokes cigarettes, is somewhere in between. But the Baudelaire orphans were not standing in general. They were standing outside the Hotel Denouement, at the edge of a pond where a great secret was hidden, while a crowd of guests grew more and more suspicious about the terrible thing that had just occurred. The children thought of Dewey and remembered the terrible, terrible sight of him sinking into the pond, and they realized they had no way of knowing if they themselves were good or evil, let alone the mysterious man towering over them.
"We don't know,"
Sonny said finally.
"Baudelaires!"
came a sharp voice at the top of the stairs, followed by a fit of coughing, and the siblings turned to see Mr. Poe, who was staring at the children and covering his mouth with a white handkerchief.
"What has happened?"
he asked.
"Where is that man you shot with the harpoon?"
The Baudelaires were too weary and unhappy to argue with Mr. Poe's description of what happened.
"He's dead,"
Violet said, and found that tears were in her eyes once more. Mr. Poe coughed once more in astonishment, and then stepped down the stairs and stood in front of the children, whose welfare had been his responsibility.
"Dead?" he said. "How did that happen?"
"It's difficult to say," Klaus said.
"Difficult to say?" Mr. Poe frowned. "But I saw you, Baudelaire's. You were holding the weapon. Surely you can tell me what happened." "Henri Bergson," Sonny said,
which meant, "It's more complicated than that." But Mr. Poe only shook his head, as if he'd heard enough.
"You'd better come inside," he said with a weary sigh. "I must say I'm very disappointed in you children. When I was in charge of your affairs, no matter how many homes I found for you, terrible things occurred. Then, when you decided to handle your own affairs, the Daily Punctilio brought more and more news of your treachery with each passing day. And now that I've found you again, I see that once more an unfortunate event has occurred, and another guardian is dead. You should be ashamed of yourselves."
The Baudelaires did not answer. Dewey Desnoumont, of course, had not been their official guardian at the Hotel Desnoumont, but he had looked after them, even when they did not know it, and he had done his best to protect them from the villainous people lurking around their home. Even though he wasn't a proper guardian, he was a good guardian, and the children were ashamed of themselves for their participation in his unfortunate death. In silence they waited, while Mr. Poe had another fit of coughing, and then the banker put his hands on the Baudelaire's shoulders, pushing them toward the entrance to the hotel.
"There are people who say that criminal behavior is the destiny of children from a broken home," he said. "Perhaps such people are right."
"This isn't our destiny," Klaus said, but he did not sound very sure, and Mr. Poe merely gave him a sad, stern look and kept pushing. If someone taller than you has ever reached down to push you by the shoulder, then you know this is not a pleasant way to travel. But the Baudelaires were too upset and confused to care. Up the stairs they went, the banker plodding behind them in his ugly pyjamas, and only when they reached the cloud of steam that still wafted across the entrance did they think to look back at the mysterious man who had offered them a ride. By then the man was already back inside the taxi and was driving slowly away from the Hotel Desnoumont, and just as the children had no way of knowing if he was a good person or not, they had no way of knowing if they were sad or relieved to see him go. And even after months of research and many sleepless nights and many dreary afternoons spent in front of an enormous pond throwing stones in hopes that someone would notice the ripples I was making, I have no way of knowing if the Baudelaire should have been sad or relieved to see him go, either. I do know who the man was, and I do know where he went afterward, and I do know the name of the woman who was hiding in the trunk, and the type of musical instrument that was laid carefully in the back seat, and the ingredients of the sandwich tucked into the glove compartment, and even the small item that sat on the passenger seat, still damp from its hiding place. But I cannot tell you if the Baudelaires would have been happier in this man's company, or if it was better that he drove away from the three siblings, looking back at them through the rear-view mirror, and clutching a monogrammed napkin in his trembling hand. I do know that if they had gotten into his taxi, their troubles at the Hotel Desnoumont would not have been their penultimate peril, and they would have had quite a few more woeful events in their lives that would likely take 13 more books to describe, but I have no way of knowing if it would have been better for the orphans, any more than I know if it would have been better for me, had I decided to continue my life's work rather than researching the Baudelaire story, or if it would have been better for my sister had she decided to join the children at the Hotel Desnoumont instead of water-skiing toward Captain Widdershins and later water-skiing away from him, or if it would have been better for you to step into that taxicab you saw not so long ago and embark on your own series of events rather than continuing with the life you have for yourself. There is no way of knowing. When there is no way of knowing, one can only imagine. And I imagine that the Baudelaire orphans were quite frightened indeed when they walked through the entrance to the hotel and saw the crowd of people waiting for them in the lobby.
"There they are!"
roared someone from the back of the room. The children could not see who it was, because the lobby was as crowded as it had been when they first set foot in the perplexing hotel. It had been strange to walk through the enormous domed room that morning, passing unnoticed in their concierge disguises, but this time every person in the lobby was looking directly at them. The children were amazed to see countless familiar faces from every chapter of their lives, and saw many, many people they could not be sure if they recognized or not. Everyone was wearing pyjamas, nightgowns, or other sleep wear, and was glaring at the Baudelaires through eyes squinty from being awakened in the middle of the night. It is always interesting to observe what people are wearing in the middle of the night, although there are more pleasant ways to make such observations without being accused of murder.
"Those are the murderers!"
"They're no ordinary murderers," cried Geraldine Julien,
who was wearing a bright yellow nightshirt and had a shower cap over her hair.
"They're the Baudelaire orphans!"
A ripple of astonishment went through the pyjamaed crowd, and the children wished they had thought to put their sunglasses back on.
"The Baudelaire orphans!" cried Sir,
whose pyjamas had the initials L.S. stenciled over the pocket, presumably for lucky smells.
"I remember them. They had caused accidents in my lumber mill."
"The accidents weren't their fault," Charles said,
whose pyjamas matched his partner's.
"They were the fault of Count Olaf."
"Count Olaf is another one of their victims," cried a woman dressed in a bright pink bathrobe.
The Baudelaires recognized her as Mrs. Morrow, one of the citizens of the village of foul devotees.
"He was murdered right in my hometown."
"That was Count Omar,"
said another citizen of the town, a man named Mr. Lesko, who apparently slept in the same plaid pants he wore during the day.
"I'm sure the Baudelaires aren't murderers," said Jerome Squalor. "I was their guardian, and I always found them to be polite and kind."
"They were pretty good students, if I remember correctly," said Mr. Remora,
who was wearing a nightcap shaped like a banana.
"They were pretty good students, if I remember correctly,"
Vice Principal Nero mimicked.
"They were nothing of the sort. Violet and Klaus flunked all sorts of tests, and Sonny was the worst administrative assistant I've ever seen.
I say they're criminals,"
Mrs. Bass said, adjusting her wig,
"and criminals ought to be punished."
"Yes,"
said Hugo.
"Criminals are too freakish to be running around loose."
"They're not criminals," Hal said firmly, "and I should know."
"So should I," retorted Esme Squalor, "and I say the guilty as sin."
Her long silver fingernails rested on the shoulder of Carmelita Spatz, who was glaring at the siblings as Mr. Poe pushed them past.
"I think they're guiltier than that,"
said one of the hotel bellboys.
"I think they're even guiltier than you think they are,"
cried another.
"I think they look like nice kids,"
said someone the children did not recognize.
"I think they look like vicious criminals," said another person. "I think they look like noble volunteers," said another.
"I think they look like treacherous villains. I think they look like concierges. One of them looks a bit like my mother."
"Wrong. Wrong. Wrong." The lobby seemed to shake as the clock struck 3 in the morning. By now Mr. Poe had escorted the Baudelaires to a far corner of the lobby, where either Frank or Ernest was waiting next to the door marked 121, with a grim expression on his face, as the last wrong echoed in the enormous room.
"Ladies and gentlemen,"
the children turned to see Justice Strauss, who was standing on one of the wooden benches so she could be seen, and clapping her hands for attention.
"Please settle down,"
The matter of the Baudelaire's guilt or innocence is not for you to decide.
Well, that doesn't seem fair,
remarked a man in pyjamas, with a pattern of salmon swimming upstream.
After all, they woke us up in the middle of the night.
The case is a matter for the High Court, Justice Strauss said. The authorities have been notified, and the other judges of the court are on their way. We will be able to begin the trial in a matter of hours.
I thought the trial was on Thursday,
said a woman in a nightgown emblazoned with dancing clowns.
Showing up early is one of the signs of a noble person, Justice Strauss said. Once the other noble judges have arrived, we will decide on this matter and other equally important matters once and for all.
There was a murmur of discussion in the crowd.
I suppose that's all right, grumbled someone.
All right, Geraldine Julien said. It's wonderful. I can see the headline now. High Court finds Baudelaire's guilty.
No one is guilty until the trial is over, Justice Strauss said. And for the first time, the judge gazed down at the children and gave them a gentle smile. It was a small mercy, that smile, and the frightened Baudelaire smiled back. Justice Strauss stepped off the bench and walked through the murmuring crowd, followed by Jerome Squalor.
Don't worry, children, Jerome said. It looks like you won't have to wait until tomorrow for justice to be served.
I hope so, Violet said.
I thought judges weren't allowed to reach verdicts on people they know, Klaus said.
Normally that's true, Justice Strauss said. The law should be impartial and fair, but I think I can be fair where Count Olaf is concerned.
Besides, Jerome said, there are two other judges on the High Court. Justice Strauss's opinion is not the only one that matters.
I trust my fellow judges, Justice Strauss said. I've known them for years, and they've always been concerned whenever I've reported on your case. While we wait for them to arrive, however, I've asked the managers of the hotel to put you in room 121 to keep you away from this angry crowd.
Without a word, Frank or Ernest unlocked the door and revealed the small, bare closet where Violet had found the harpoon gun.
We'll be locked up, Klaus said nervously.
Just to keep you safe, Justice Strauss said, until the trial begins.
Yes,
cried a voice the children would never forget. The crowd parted to reveal Count Olaf, who walked toward the Baudelaires with a triumphant gleam in his eyes.
Lock them up, he said. We can't have treacherous people running around the hotel. There are noble, decent people here.
Really?
Asked Colette.
Ha!
Count Olaf said.
I mean, of course. The High Court will decide who's noble and who's wicked. In the meantime, the orphans should be locked in a closet.
Hear, hear,
Kevin said, raising one arm and then the other in an ambidextrous salute.
They're not the only ones, Justice Strauss said sternly. You, sir, have also been accused of a great deal of treachery, and the High Court is very interested in your case as well. You will be locked in room 165 until the trial begins.
The man who was not Frank, but Ernest, or vice versa, stepped sternly out of the crowd and took Olaf's arm.
Fair enough, said Olaf. I'm happy to wait for the verdict of the High Court. Ha!
The three siblings looked at one another, and then around the lobby, where the crowd was looking fiercely back at them. They did not want to be locked in a small room, no matter what the reason, and they could not understand why the idea of the High Court reaching a verdict on Count Olaf made him laugh. However, they knew that arguing with the crowd would be bootless, a word which here means likely to get the siblings in even more trouble. And so, without another word, the three Baudelaires stepped inside the closet. Jerome and Justice Strauss gave them a little wave, and Mr. Poe gave them a little cough, and either Frank or Ernest stepped forward to shut the door. At the sight of the manager, the children suddenly thought not of Dewey, but of the family left behind, just as Violet, Klaus, and Sonny were all left behind after that first day at Briny Beach and the dreadful news they received there.
We're sorry,
Sonny said, and the manager looked down at the youngest Baudelaire and blinked. Perhaps he was frank and thought the Baudelaires had done something wicked, or perhaps he was earnest and thought the Baudelaires had done something noble. But in either case, the manager looked surprised that the children were sorry. For a moment he paused and gave them a tiny nod, but then he shut the door, and the Baudelaire children were alone. The door of room 121 was surprisingly thick, and although the light of the lobby shone clearly through the gap at the bottom of the door, the noise of the crowd was nothing but a faint buzzing, like a swarm of bees, or the workings of a machine. The orphans sank to the floor, exhausted from their busy day and their terrible, terrible night. They took off their shoes and leaned against one another in the cramped surroundings, trying to find a comfortable position, and listening to the buzz of the arguing crowd in the lobby.
"What will happen to us?" Violet asked.
"I don't know," Klaus said.
"Perhaps we should have run," Violet said. "Like you suggested, Klaus."
"Perhaps at a trial," the middle Baudelaire said. "The villains at last will be brought to justice."
"Olaf?"
Sonny asked.
"Or us?"
What Sonny asked, of course, was whether Count Olaf was the villain who would be brought to justice, or if it would be the three Baudelaires. But her siblings had no answer for her. Instead, the eldest Baudelaire leaned down and kissed the top of her sister's head, and Klaus leaned up to kiss Violet's, and Sonny moved her head first to the right and then to the left to kiss both of them. If you had been in the lobby of the Hotel Denouement, you would not have heard anything from behind the thick door of room 121 as the Baudelaires ended their conversation with a great, shuddering sigh and nestled close to one another in the small space. You would have had to be on the other side of the door, leaning against the children yourself, to hear the tiny, quiet sounds as the Baudelaire orphans cried themselves to sleep, unable to answer Sunny's question.
Stars don't cry. Even babies kill. Even babies kill. And the stars are.